Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up later this hour, it's one of Iowa's oldest universities. In fact, it's older than our state itself. In just a few minutes, we'll hear about the closure announced this week of Iowa Wesleyan University. Also, the unwinding of Medicaid is about to start as pandemic coverage protections end. Toward the end of the hour, a fascinating conversation with archaeologist Matt Hill of Iowa State University on the recent discovery of a saber-toothed cat skull in Iowa. That's the first evidence that that prehistoric predator was here more than 10,000 years ago. Well, let's get back to the present. Today marks the end of the second funnel week at the Iowa State House. Translation of that, most policy bills need approval from either the House or the Senate and a committee in the opposite chamber to remain eligible for debate after this week. Let's check in with Kathy Obradovich, editor-in-chief of Iowa Capital Dispatch. Welcome back, Kathy.
Hi, Ben.
Let's concentrate on what made it through this second funnel, first of all, and the education bill, the governor's education proposal. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, both the House and Senate have been working independently on this legislation, which was originally proposed by the governor. And interestingly, you know, they're all run by Republicans, the House, the Senate, the governor's a Republican, but they really don't all agree on the details of every piece of legislation. And a lot of what we're seeing this week is where some of those fault lines are. So, for example, the Senate passed the bill that prohibited books that are available in school libraries, basically if they had any kind of written or visual depiction of sex acts. The House Republicans thought that was too restrictive, and so they amended the bill. Actually, they rewrote the whole bill, but they amended the bill to say that those depictions have to be graphic. So essentially, they're raising the bar a little bit on what books school libraries would have to remove. There was a provision dealing with LGBTQ kids saying in their original bill that school staff would have to notify parents if they believe a child is transgender. And then it was added because people raised concern about safety of children, that the school would have to contact the Department of Health and Human Services, basically get Child Protective Services involved, if they believe the parent of the child would put them in danger when learning about the child's gender identity. So really controversial. So the new version rolls that provision back, basically says, you know, the school staff can't give any kind of false information on the student's gender identity, and that they still have to inform parents if the child wants to use a different name or different pronouns than what they were given at birth. But they took out that whole HHS contact requirement. So there are more changes in the bill. The House also added a bunch of bills that they had passed earlier in the session that the Senate hasn't taken up. But some significant changes in that bill, and the Senate is going to have to decide whether they're going to take those changes. The House and Senate, I'm not so sure how much negotiation they've done between the chambers on these. So we may see this play out now through the end of the legislative session.
Let's move on to a couple of other bills that survived this second funnel. A measure that would limit the state auditor's power. Our current state auditor, Rob Sand, tell us about that.
Yeah, this is really interesting. And people probably aren't as engaged as they should be with this. The state auditor's job to actually investigate or audit state agencies and you know, look for and report any kind of wasted money, fraud, failure to comply with state law. And what Republicans are trying to do under the argument of privacy protection is to really seriously limit information that the auditor can get their hands on in the course of an audit. So, for example, if they're investigating student loans, that they wouldn't be able to look at a student's GPA or other information that would otherwise be considered private. And they're basically, you know, making the argument that, you know, they don't need this information, that, you know, we're trying to protect Iowa's privacy. Well, the auditor says, you know, we are going to be handcuffed if we want to, you know, we're investigating fraud, and the subject of the investigation has to agree under this law that their private banking information is confidential and that the auditor can't get their hands on it. So, and, you know, the auditors, there's a big political element to this. The state auditor, Rob Sand, is the only remaining Democratic statewide office holder. All of the others were defeated in the 2022 election. He also has raised the possibility that it was retaliation for something that he had said about the University of Iowa athletic director. Republicans often say that they are worried about waste, fraud, and abuse. You know, they're trying to overhaul, you know, how people are eligible for public assistance programs because they're afraid of waste, fraud, and abuse. And they're saying that legislation like this would actually handcuff the auditor's office when it's his job to actually root out waste, fraud, and abuse. So it's going to be an interesting discussion.
One more high profile item that made it through the second funnel. Talk about trucking liability.
Yeah, this was actually one of Governor Reynolds' priorities, and it's a bill that's been hanging out there for a while. The Motor Truck Association wrote the bill, and they have been very persistent. Basically, what it would do is cap liability for commercial vehicle companies, so that the employer, their liability would be capped. Under the original Senate bill, it would have been capped at $2 million. For non-economic damages. So that would be things like pain and suffering, loss of consortium, those things that aren't, you know, direct medical bills or loss of wages, for example, for victims of accidents that were caused by trucking company employees. So that bill also has been very, very controversial, hasn't made it through the past few years. It came over from the Senate to the House, and the House is now also watering that bill down. So the House actually passed the bill with a $5 million cap on non-economic damages and some other changes that that make it a little bit more, you know, tilt the balance a little bit more toward the victims of the accidents. There have been some high-profile Republican defections from these tort liability bills. There were several who didn't vote for medical malpractice because they just have a moral objection to putting a price tag on people's lives. So it's that same principle is at play here in this trucker tort bill. So again, that's going to be one of those things that the House and Senate have to work out before the end of session.
Mm-hmm. And quickly, let's talk about a couple of high-profile items. Talk about controversial that did not make it through this funnel, it appears. The carbon pipeline proposal passed by the House in March, and the big controversial issue about public land acquisition. Cover those quickly for us, please, Kathy.
Yeah, these are both you know, really controversial issues in rural Iowa. The pipeline issue, which I'm sure your readers are familiar with, deals most centrally with the principle of eminent domain. Projects of public importance can ask the government to force reluctant landowners to give them an easement across their property, which they would pay for. But, you know, ultimately, there are some landowners out there who say they don't want this pipeline crossing their land at any price. So pipelines are hoping to these projects, two of the three projects that are being developed in Iowa are hoping to get access to that eminent domain power to cross land through their routes. The House Republicans want to limit the ability of these pipeline companies to get eminent domain. They passed a bill that said they have to get 90% of the landowners along the route to agree voluntarily before they could ask for the government's help to secure the rest. There are other aspects of the bill. Senate did not take the bill up. That doesn't necessarily mean it's the end of the line. You know, the House and Senate, these issues can come into play in budget negotiations. And House Speaker Pat Grassley has said he doesn't know what the future of the bill is at this point. He did acknowledge it's probably not a very healthy future. But they're, you know, I don't think they've quite given up on it yet. And then the public lands bill, again, this is a bill that is being pushed most by the Cattlemen Association, but Farm Bureau also does not like the state's current public lands policy. You know, they want the state not to be buying new public land, but just to focus on maintenance of the public land that they have already. That bill would have essentially said that it would be the state's priority for maintenance as over acquisition. It didn't have any direct prohibition on the state buying new public lands. But the bill, again, this is another one that passed out of the Senate, has stalled in the House despite the fact that they've shopped around for various committees and they still haven't been able to get enough supporters.
Okay. What survived the second funnel and what failed to survive, we think. Kathy Obradovich of the Iowa Capital Dispatch joining us. Thank you so much, Kathy. And I'll just note here that Robin Upsall of Iowa Capital Dispatch will be joining us on Monday with other State House reporters to talk about the second funnel deadline in depth. Kathy Obradovich, thank you so much for now.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about the closure of Iowa Wesleyan University. When your news buzz continues, I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, it's one of Iowa's oldest universities. In fact, it's older than our state, than the state of Iowa itself. This week, a real surprise, it announced it's closing its doors after 181 years. Iowa Wesleyan University, that's in the southeast Iowa community of Mount Pleasant, closing. The closure announced Tuesday following a unanimous vote by the university's Board of Trustees. Joining us to talk about it a bit, Samantha Hernandez, education reporter with the Des Moines Register. Hello, Samantha.
Hey, Ben. How are you today?
I'm fine. Let's talk about this. A surprise this week, closing doors later this year after budgetary struggles. I guess budgetary struggles stretching back a few years. Tell us more about the reasons given for the closing.
So the reasons given for the closing actually go back, you know, at least until 2018. We've some documents have showed 2013, but as far back as 2018, the school announced that it would need to raise, you know, $4.6 million to stay open through December of 2019. And they were able to do that through community donations and leveraging real estate. And then And as well as we know that most recently they had taken out a large loan with the USDA that they actually put their campus up as collateral for.
Mm-hmm. And in your article on this, it was interesting that Iowa Wesleyan has lost millions of dollars every fiscal year since at least 2013, records obtained by ProPublica. And also an interesting aspect here is that there was a bid by this university to get COVID funding. Tell us about that from our Governor Reynolds.
Yeah, so the university approached Reynolds' office to ask for $12 million to cover ongoing operating costs. And an independent review showed that this influx of funds would not do much more than kind of keep the school afloat. And the auditors, you know, recommended that if, you know, this money was dispersed through the school, that, you know, Governor Reynolds' administration, you know, kind of go through a system of checks and balances to make sure that they were maintaining that fiscal health. And Governor Reynolds' office, as we know now, turned down that request. And one of the reasons was that the university had put its entire campus up for collateral against a USDA loan of about, it has about $26.1 million in loans from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And those loans, according to Governor Reynolds' office, could be recalled in full as early as November 2023.
And I think the long and short of it is the governor said this would not solve systemic problems at Wesleyan University. That's interesting. Also, in your article, interesting, you mentioned 2018. They did a fundraising campaign back then to raise several million dollars, managing to achieve that goal. And as you mentioned, leveraging some real estate. Let's talk a little bit about the history of Iowa Wesleyan, since, as I mentioned, its founding precedes Iowa's statehood. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so the university was founded by Methodist settlers in Mount Pleasant, and as we know that Iowa was became a state in 1846, the school was actually established in 1842, making it amongst the oldest in the state at 181 years.
And there's some notable graduates from Iowa Wesleyan mentioned in your piece about this. Tell us about them.
Yeah, so there's Peggy Whitson, the first female commander of the International Space Station, Belle Babb Mansfield, the first woman admitted to the bar as a lawyer in the United States, and then James Van Allen, who discovered the Earth's radiation belt. So some, you know, real contributors to U.S. history here.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, you hint at this in the article, I don't know what you can tell us, that Iowa Wesleyan is not the only institution of higher education facing financial issues. This is a wider problem for some institutions. You call them in the article marginal higher education institutions, and it has to do with the ending of pandemic aid.
Mm-hmm. And as we know, you know, across the country, schools and universities are going to be kind of grappling with the end of these one-time COVID relief funds. And but here in Iowa, there were four universities, and we, as of yet, don't know the names of them. We put in a request with the governor's office, but we don't know much more about which universities these are or how much money that they've asked for.
How will Iowa Wesleyan shut down later this year?
So what we know from officials about what's going to happen with the shutdown is that for students, they're going to kind of have that normal end of the year experience. There's still going to be a graduation ceremony and such, but students are continuing on to work on their degrees. They're going to have to choose another university to attend. Wesleyan has set it up so that they have several several universities that they can transfer to at kind of the same tuition rates, as well as receiving, you know, similar financial aid. And the campus itself, once the closure occurs, will be taken over by the USDA, which, as we know, is headed by former Mount Pleasant Mayor, U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack.
So this is a big blow for the community there, the community of Mount Pleasant, less than 1,000 residents there. So we had over 100 full-time employees at the university and other faculty. So that will be something that community will have to come to grips with, won't it?
Yes, definitely. And I know one of the things when Governor Reynolds issued a statement following the announcement by the university, that, you know, she has been in contact with the Iowa Economic Development Authority and Iowa Workforce Development to work with the community and business leaders to kind of, I think, you know, stem any fallout from closure of the university.
Thank you, Samantha Hernandez, education reporter with the Des Moines Register, talking about this week's surprise announcement that Iowa Wesleyan University closing its doors after 181 years. Samantha, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you, Ben.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later in the program, you won't want to miss this. We discuss the recent discovery of a saber-toothed cat skull here in Iowa. And I'll talk with an Iowa State University archaeologist who helped analyze the remarkably well-preserved specimen. As a matter of fact, it's the first evidence that the prehistoric predator, the saber-toothed cat, was once here on this terrain we now call Iowa. That later in the program. Well, it's being called the unwinding of Medicaid. At the end of this week, states begin to sever an anticipated 15 million low-income Americans from Medicaid rolls. Now remember, Medicaid provides health coverage to many millions of Americans, including not only low-income adults, but also children, pregnant women, the elderly, people with disabilities. So what does this so-called unwinding mean for those impacted especially, and for access to health care across the country and here in Iowa? Let's talk with Pete Damiano, University of Iowa professor and health policy expert. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Evan. Great to be back.
This unwinding of Medicaid is the undoing of something that was done during the pandemic. Start by taking us back. What was that?
Sure. So back in March of 2020, toward the beginning of the pandemic, it was basically determined that there's two reasons we want to keep people with their health insurance coverage. One is for their individual health, and the other is for population health, if you will, and that by individuals taking care of themselves when they're in the middle of an infectious pandemic, it will help others. And so the federal government determined that they were going to keep people who were in the Medicaid program, as you mentioned, that's a wide swath of people eligible until we determined that the pandemic was over. And so since March of 2020, people who have been staying enrolled and eligible for Medicaid this entire time. And then as a result of a bill with the omnibus budget bill last fall, beginning to reevaluate and reassess people's eligibility right now across the country for people in Medicaid.
Okay, so this is the end of this temporary guarantee that preserved this safety net health coverage for the past three or so years. And April 1st is the date at which things begin to happen, because this is a program, Medicaid, right? It's where the federal government works with different states. So we've got, 50 different things happening. So what happens beginning this weekend?
Right. So it's really the beginning of a year-long process, at least in Iowa, and it does vary from state to state. You're going to start hearing some things, and in some states, people may be actually losing their eligibility right now. In Iowa, it's going to be spread out over a year, and Medicaid eligibility is a very complex process based on both the person's income and the category, like you were mentioning. If you're a mom or you're a child, you're a person with disability, your income level and eligibility is different. And then you start getting in the complexity of that there is a combination of federal money that goes in to support the program and state money for much of the Medicaid program. It's about two-thirds federal, one-third state. For the Medicaid expansion population, the Iowa Health and Wellness Plan is 90% federal, 10% state. So you can understand the complexity of this and how this unwinding is really something that's going to be a challenge.
Okay, so it sounds like a big challenge is here is for each state, the people responsible in each state here in Iowa as well, to figure out who is still eligible. Is that the core of it?
Right. And so during the pandemic, this was actually a very effective program in terms of keeping people with health insurance. So at the federal level, the program grew by about 30%, up to 91 million people. In Iowa, it grew by about 24% from about 675,000 to about 840,000 people eligible. So it's been a really important and successful, I would say, program to be able to keep people with their health insurance. But now they're going to start going back and really seeing, are these people still eligible for the program? There's going to be some people that during this time period, for example, got a job that had health insurance. You're going to have some people that might have gotten their health insurance through the health insurance marketplace. There might be some other people whose income just went up too much, even if they don't have health insurance, that they're not going to be eligible for Medicaid. So that's what this unwinding is really all about, to try to reevaluate where each of the people, their individual situation is relative to regular Medicaid eligibility.
Focus in on our state, Pete. What can you say about the people that will be impacted within our borders?
Well, as I said, the enrollment went up by about 24% between early 2020 and the end of last year, which was the most current numbers we have. And so that's going to be the process. We'll be looking at all of that. And the way that the state has opted to do it is they're going to be spreading that out over the next year so that they can properly go about this process, communicating with people on a monthly basis, sending out information, and be able to reevaluate, you know, people's eligibility.
And so I'm just wondering, you know, listeners out there are probably wondering as well, those on Medicaid, how will those affected experience this unwinding if it impacts them? Will it be a writing? Will it be a call? Or what is it likely to be?
Right. So they should be getting a letter. And one of the really important things is, number one, be looking, you know, at your mail closely and to see if there is some communication that is coming from the Medicaid program. But also don't be alarmed if you don't get something right away. If they are concerned, one of the more other really important things is to make sure that their contact information with the Department of Health and Human Services, and Medicaid is just recently, which is a part of the Department of Human Services and now is changing their name to the Department of Health and Human Services, which could be a little confusing for some people, but just understand that that's what's going on concurrently with this. But they can reach out and they can either call the DHHS office number, and the most effective way to do that would be to contact their income maintenance customer service call center. Mm-hmm. That number is 877-347-5678. If they already have an online ID number or they want to establish one, they can go online to the DHS services portal, it's called, and they can update their information there. And that information is on the DHHS website. There's also, if they're just kind of wondering about what's going on, there's also the DHS contact center, which they can call 855-889-7985. If they want to just discuss what's happening. But for the individual, it's really better to call that income maintenance service number. For other people that are interested, there's also a continuous cover unwind website that sort of discusses all of the process and has some of the information and numbers and things like that on it too.
Mm-hmm. Let's say a worst case scenario, you lose your Medicaid coverage. What other options do you have?
Right. The first one that I would recommend is going to the health insurance marketplace, and that's the healthcare.gov site. And that's where people up to 400% of poverty get a subsidy to purchase private health insurance that's available in Iowa. And so that would be one of the first places that I would suggest reaching out is looking at the Health Insurance Marketplace website.
Yeah. Am I correct in saying that this will impact coverage for millions of children in the country?
Yes, absolutely. This affects, all of the different categories that you had talked about, the people that are eligible. Most people think of this as a poor moms and kids program. A lot of the people, though, most of the money actually goes to people in nursing homes and people with disabilities. Now, there's a good chance that those people will be maintaining their eligibility, but they still have to make sure that they're getting that information in there, looking for the mail that's coming so they can stay eligible. But yes, all categories, could be moms, could be everyone who's potentially going to be affected, basically everyone that's in Medicaid.
Okay, thank you very much. Pete Damiano, University of Iowa professor, health policy expert, very complex area of our health landscape. Thank you for making it clearer what will be happening as of April 1st and spreading out over many months.
Great. Thank you very much, Ben.
It's your Friday News Buzz. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A complete saber-tooth cat skull was discovered in southwest Iowa, and that discovery provides the first evidence that this iconic prehistoric predator roamed the terrain we now call Iowa. Matt Hill joins me now. He is an Iowa State University professor of archaeology and expert on animal bones. He analyzed this specimen in collaboration with David Esterly at Northwest Missouri State University, and their findings are newly published in the Journal of Quaternary Science Reviews. Matt Hill, welcome to the program.
Hi, glad to be here.
Tell us about this discovery. Where was it found and what was found?
Yeah, so this specimen was found in 2017, eroding from the sands and gravel deposits along the East Nishnabotna River in northwestern Page County, down in southwestern Iowa. And it's absolutely a spectacular specimen. Its physical condition is more or less pristine. It was probably buried shortly after the animal died, only to be exposed and found. And that's what allowed us to research a specimen.
Describe this for our mind's eye. Set it on a table in front of us and describe what you actually see and feel when you hold it, when you touch it, when you look at it.
Well, if you were to pick the skull up, you would say this is a really big animal. And it is, in fact, a really big animal. But the most distinctive feature of saber-toothed cats are its sword-like canine teeth that are upwards of 4 to 6 inches long, and they're like knife blades. And they literally were driven into probably the necks of very large prey to incapacitate them and kill them. These were super predators. And that is what you would see. You would see these massive canines, a big animal, and you would be terrified.
Right. And it's very similar to, others in the cat family, a cat skull. Many of us have seen cat skulls. So it's like a very large cat skull. And then it's got these huge dagger-like teeth, canines coming down. But only one of them is in this specimen, though, right?
Yeah, well, our modern cats, like our modern lions, they certainly have canine teeth, and they're pretty ferocious when we see them on TV and in zoos, but this animal's teeth are off the charts. And in our case, this animal only has one tooth that is still intact. The other canine, one of the canines, is broken off at the roof of the mouth where the tooth enters the palate. And there are characteristics of that fracture on that tooth that lead us to think that it was broken right around the time the animal died. It was it broke when the tooth was still fresh or living. And although we can't say for certain, it may have happened during an encounter with a prey animal that ultimately turned lethal for the predator in this case. Mm.
May have had something to do with this animal's death. When did you learn of this discovery, Matt?
Well, we learned it came to light in 2017, and we've been working on it over the course of that period. And it takes quite a while to do research like this. The paper is very detailed, very technical.
Mm-hmm. And so other saber-toothed cats have, the fossils have been discovered in North America, but not in this area?
Yeah, that's correct. So there are saber-toothed cats, remains of these animals scattered across the United States. And certainly the most famous location where they've been found are the tar seep death traps in downtown Los Angeles, California, where the remains of over 1,000 individual saber-toothed cats were trapped and ultimately died there. But that's highly unusual. Across the rest of the United States, there's about bits and pieces of 70 other individuals. And the Iowa saber-tooth is certainly the most spectacular outside of downtown Los Angeles.
You said this was a rare find. How rare, how lucky was this find?
Well, I've said it before. It's like finding a needle in a haystack of needles. That's how rare they are. Very rare.
And you said remarkably well-preserved.
Incredibly well-preserved.
Do you know what led to such a great preservation of this specimen?
Well, almost certainly it had, after the animal died, somehow it was buried relatively quickly, and it was protected from other carnivore scavengers, ultraviolet radiation, lousy soil chemistry that would have destroyed the bone. It was protected for 12.5, 13,000 years until it was found and exposed.
Mm-hmm. Take us back 12 or 13,000 years ago. What was this terrain, this land we now call Iowa, like then?
Well, the landscape, the shape of it would have been generally similar to what it is today. The big ice sheet that was across central Iowa was probably in northern Minnesota at the time the cat was living. The Des Moines River was the main drainage for a lot of meltwater that was coming out of that ice sheet well to the north. But the animals that were on the landscape, it would have been much like an African Serengeti. We had these very large carnivores like our saber-toothed cat. We would have had a animal called the giant short-faced bear. We would have had dire wolves. We would have had American lions, perhaps, in our part of the world, mammoths, mastodons, muskox, caribou. They would have all been out there, a few bison. And then for whatever reason, right around 12.5, 13,000 years ago, most of those animals vanished. They're no longer found anywhere. And the only animal that survived was bison. And so we go from this wonderful menagerie of huge animals, large carnivores, large herbivores, down to one, and that's our bison. And
yeah. It sounds like there's...
Why that happened, we do not know.
Right. That's where I wanted to go. It sounds like there's some puzzlement there about why that drastic drop-off in species.
Yeah. Archaeologists, paleontologists, ecologists, zoologists have tried to understand the cause of these late Ice Age extinctions for a couple hundred years. And we are still a long ways from resolution. On one hand, we have people who think that, researchers who think that human hunters are responsible for the death of these animals, or at least they provided a coup de grace for these animals. Other people would argue that there's some climatic variable that is responsible for the death of these animals. Whatever the case may be, it seems improbable that it has to do with people, given the scale of this extinction event, the number of animals involved, 35 genera, the timing in which it happened, like within 1,000 years or so, and the geographic scale. All of these animals in South America and North America vanished in basically a geological instant within, say, 1,000 years. Makes it highly improbable that people had something to do with it. But exactly what the climatic variable or environmental variable was is very difficult to pinpoint. It's probably multi-causal.
You, Matt Hill, and David Easterly worked on the analysis of this remarkable specimen. What can you say about it specifically? What can you tell from what's left of, well, it's the skull, I guess. None of the bones of the body are there, but what can you tell from the specimen?
Well, we know that its condition has allowed us to glean some really important information about the life history of this animal. So, for example, the bones of the skull. So a skull is comprised of multiple separate bones, and as the animal gets older, they fuse together, they seal. Well, in the Iowa cat, many of these bones are still open, and the animal is still growing. The head of this animal is still growing. Also, the teeth, they're fully erupted. All the permanent teeth are there. The adult teeth are there, but they are very, very lightly worn or unworn. All things considered, we think it was 2 to 3 years old when it died. And also, based on its overall size in comparison with the saber-toothed cats from downtown Los Angeles, it's larger than any of those. So we think that it's a subadult male. And size comparisons, rough estimates, we place its weight right around 250 kilograms, so roughly 500 pounds when it reached the prime of life and if it was in good condition.
Let me ask the Jurassic Park question. Any DNA in this specimen?
It wouldn't surprise me if it was possible to extract ancient DNA from this specimen. The preservation of the organic material in the bone, the collagen, is extremely well preserved. So it's possible it's there, and maybe somebody in the future will try to pursue some research along the evolutionary history of this animal through the DNA.
What happens with this specimen now?
Well, right now that's kind of up in the air. Dr. Easterly and I are trying to figure out where it belongs. And there's a lot of good homes for it, and we don't quite know yet.
Okay, fascinating work. Excitement. I can feel your excitement, Matt Hill. Do you remember the moment when you first glimpsed this specimen?
Yeah, the first I saw of it was a picture. And I didn't believe it. I thought it was not from Iowa. It had to be from somewhere else. And then I started snooping around a little bit, and lo and behold, it turned out to be real.
Yeah.
It's really remarkable. One other thing is that I've spent about the last 10 or 15 years working hard on the Ice Age animals of Iowa, and it's the record of these animals in Iowa is simply second to none. We have a really great fossil record, better than any place in the United States, except for probably parts of Canada and Alaska and maybe Florida. It's literally remarkable. It's really spectacular. And this cat is just one of the neat finds that we have.
Matt Hill, thank you so much. Iowa State University Professor of Archaeology. He analyzed this remarkable specimen of a saber-toothed cat skull discovered in southwest Iowa, and in collaboration with David Easterly at Northwest Missouri State University. Thanks for the conversation, Matt.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
And we've come to the end of this NewsBuzz edition of River to River from IPR News on this very last day of March 2023, the 31st. All we need to do, and it's a very important part of our Friday program, We have to ease ourselves into the weekend. Actually, we groove ourselves into the weekend with the help of IPR Studio One. Mark Simmet is with us, a Studio One Tracks host. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Ben.
Help us out here after another heavy, busy, hectic, I don't know, tense news week. What do you got for us to groove us into the weekend?
Well, first up, I have a new song from an album that'll be out in late April from the band The National, known for their vocalist gives them their unique sound, Matt Berenger, the lead vocalist, the frontman of The National. They have a new album coming out end of April, as I said. It has the intriguing title of First Two Pages of Frankenstein, although it is not a concept album. It's just that's what they called the album. And the first track lead single from this new record is titled Tropic Morning News.
With Tropic Morning News from their upcoming album, strangely titled, at least to my mind, First Two Pages of Frankenstein. Mark, we have time for one more.
Well, next up we have Feist, who is back. She's a Canadian singer-songwriter. She's back after 6 years with a new album. It's been that long, and there have been, of course, like as with everyone, events in her life that she is reflecting on, and also, of course, the unavoidable subject of COVID and that time when everything was locked down. She kind of references that on this new album. And this is a track from her new album. It's called Borrow Trouble from Feist.
At the break of day, before your wits are gathered, even before you are awake, your thoughts will find the clock to wind and put dissent into your ear, even before your eyes are open. The plot has thickened round your fear. We borrow trouble, since we all know how. It's an expression from the old days, even more true now. We borrow trouble.
The artist known as Feist, Borrow Trouble, the name of that tune. We'll go out with that, Mark. Thanks for grooving us into the weekend. You take care.
My pleasure as always. You too, Ben.
River to River today, produced by Danny Gear. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a wonderful weekend.